Well, we've all heard a familiar saying, or at least I think we're all familiar with a saying that begins with payback is something. And we'll leave that out because it tends to be generally a vulgar word that we're not about to say here, or probably anywhere. But you've probably all heard it, this notion that payback is something that comes and gets you. And it's usually in the context of, well, what goes around comes around, you've been unpleasant. Sometimes karma is thrown in there. We have all kinds of nonsense that happens. And as I was thinking of that, I wanted to get our attention, if you will, mine at least, and hopefully yours as well, with a sermon title that sort of turns that on its head. And in this particular case, it's that payback is sometimes wonderful. Because when we think of this payback being that other thing, as I said, it's usually almost a revenge kind of thing. When we say that payback is this unpleasant thing, it's because, well, you were mean to me, and now somebody else has been mean to you. So there you go. Payback is this thing. It isn't always that way. Payback doesn't have to be unpleasant. Payback sometimes can be wonderful. And I'm not so much talking about paying as in, like, your paycheck or that sort of thing. I'm talking more about the larger picture of what has happened and the response to that. And it comes out of a couple of our readings, which I'm assuming is fairly clear by now, but it comes out of our Old Testament lesson, out of the book of Joel, and out of our gospel lesson, out of the gospel according to Luke. And as I've said before, you're always maybe treading on thin ice or something when you talk about parts of the Bible you like, because, you know, then there's always the possibility that there are parts you don't like. I wouldn't go quite that far to say there are parts of the Bible that I don't like, but there are some parts of the Bible that just don't resonate with us, and that's perfectly okay. There are some parts, you read them, and you go, okay, I see the truth in that, or I understand that story, but it just doesn't click, it just doesn't connect. And then there are those passages of Scripture that really do. And what was read for us today in Joel is one of those ones for me. And I've talked about this in the past, so it won't be news, at least not to all of you. But I really like this part of Joel. I mean, I like the second half of what was read for us, where God says, I will pour out my spirit on all people, that we also hear that Peter quotes in his sermon in the book of Acts. You know, I really like that idea that as things were in the Old Testament, they will be different down the road. But what I want to talk to you about, or what grabs me the most, is from that the first half of what was read for us today. And it's because I can remember it like it happened yesterday, when I first encountered this passage of Scripture in a significant way. And that was in the kitchen of the house I grew up, or spent most of my time growing up in. I like to say sometimes that I never really left home. I lived in my parents' house until I was 26, and then I went to college, which is not really going anywhere else. I mean, I stayed other places now and then. And then I went into my own home, so I've never really left home. Which I tell you to let you know that my mother obviously was aware of me and what I was like and all of that for all of my life, from the time I was born, of course. And when I was 26 or 27 when this happened, I was a dramatically different person than I had been for a number of years. When my mother recited this to me, she didn't read it. When she recited it, it was just the two of us. We were in the kitchen, just a day, a regular day. And at this time, I was in Bible college, getting ready for ministry, was in a significant relationship with the daughter of one of my mother's oldest friends, who I'd also met at Bible college, a woman that everybody who knew the two of us said, this is a really significant and suitable relationship for you. And my mother looked at me and said, God is repaying you for those years the locusts ate. Because she was there watching the locusts eat those years. Years and years of squandered opportunity, of squandered money, of what we'd now call toxic relationships, of years in dead-end jobs and addiction, and just a litany of nothing that any parent would ever wish for any child. And I've often thought it was one of God's greatest gifts to my mother and to me that she lived long enough to see that turned around. And so when I hear this read, no matter who reads it, or if I read it aloud, or even in my head, I'm there back in that kitchen with my mother saying, God is repaying you for the years the locusts ate. God is well aware that sometimes things are lost, or stolen, thrown away, eaten by locusts. God knows these things, and God, in His infinite mercy and in His infinite justice both, lets us go through some of these things. But He says, I will repay. And what does that mean here? Does this mean that God is going to go back and judge severely those people who led me astray? No, that's got nothing to do with it here. Is God going to pronounce judgment on me for my own stupid and sinful choices? Well, perhaps He will, but we're not going to take that from this passage. What God is saying is that there was a time in your life when you went through a famine because locusts came through and ate everything good in your life, and I'm going to repay that. I'm not going to go back in time and make it as if it never happened, because it did happen. I like this metaphor because when locusts have eaten something, it's gone. It's gone. You can't get it back. And those opportunities that I had when I was 16 or 19 or 23 or whatever year it was, they're gone. The money I made, it's gone. All of those things are in the past and they've happened and they're immutable. So when God says, I'm going to repay, what does that mean? What did it mean for the people of Israel? What does it mean for us? What does it mean for me? It means that God is going to look at what could have happened. And if those locusts wouldn't have eaten up those opportunities, you would be able to accomplish these things. But even in spite of the fact that they ate up those things, you will still accomplish equivalent things. It's not a one-to-one replacement because it doesn't work that way. When I look at the relationships I had back then, and some of them are, I still do, they're friends of mine that have stuck it out for 25 or 30 or 40 years. I look at some of those relationships and they make me shudder. I look at those relationships and anybody who knew both of us would just say, you two are a disaster for each other. What on earth are you doing? Making each other miserable and thinking that's the best it got. That's what we were doing. When God repays that kind of thing, He doesn't repay it by going back and making that never happen. He repays it by allowing you to develop a relationship with other people that those from the outside look at and say, that's extraordinary. Look at you two. You bring out the best in each other almost all the time. When the two of you are together, it's more than when the two of you are separate, added together. It's amazing. That's repaying that kind of thing. God repays those opportunities that were lost because I dropped out of high school. I've told this story. I know I've told this more than once, but I just like it, so you're going to get it again. One of the ways God repaid that part of this locust consumed life was when I worked at the Bible College and Seminary as a registrar. And often I'd be talking to students. They tended to be a little bit older, usually in their first semester, somewhere in their first year, or maybe even just considering coming at all. And they talk about, well, they just didn't know if it was going to work, if it was even going to be possible, because, well, they never even finished high school. And I'd look at them and say, no one in this room has finished high school. I'd say, really? No, I dropped out of high school. It was a stupid thing to do. But it's not the end of the world. I'm here. I haven't finished high school, but I finished my master's degree. And you could see a physical change in these people. They sat up straighter. They were more encouraged. They realized that this mistake that they'd made, whether because they just chose to quit or they were forced to quit to take care of the family, whatever it might have been, wasn't as big as they thought it was. That's God repaying my locust-eaten years and theirs. God is giving these things back in ways that we could never even imagine. Payback for our stupidity. It's sometimes wonderful. I also like our gospel lesson because we have this little story, and I especially like the introduction in the New International Version, where it says, to some who are confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else, Jesus told this parable. And so Jesus tells a parable. There's a Pharisee, a religious stalwart praying in a particular way, and a non-Pharisee, in this case a tax collector, praying in a different way. We have this Pharisee saying, look at me, I am truly spectacular in every way. God, you're lucky to be my friend. Is what that comes down to, really. The tax collector is over at a distance. The tax collector, I've always viewed this, is the tax collector is as close to being outside as you can be while still being inside. Because he knows he needs to be here, but he's not pushing himself to the front of anything. And the tax collector won't even look up to heaven, beats his chest and says, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. The thing that's interesting is that both of these people are telling the truth. The Pharisee isn't lying. When the Pharisee says, I don't do these things, I'm sure it's true. When the Pharisee says, I fast twice a week, I'm sure it's true. When the Pharisee says, I give 10% of what I get, I'm sure that's true. Just doesn't matter. Because when you come to God in prayer, it's not so much a description of what you've already done or of how wonderful you are. God already knows how wonderful you are. And he does know that, by the way. All of you need to hear this, because I need to hear it now and then. You are all wonderful in God's eyes. You're all extraordinary people. And God sees that in the Pharisee, too. He doesn't have to be reminded of it. But on the basis of this prayer, when they both leave, Jesus says, only one of them was justified. Because only one of them dealt with the reality of what actually was. See, the Pharisee talked about what he did. The tax collector talked about who he was. A sinner. Just like we all are. And God looked at that, and instead of saying, you are a tax collector, you are a terrible person, and payback's going to be awful for you, payback for the tax collector was justification. That seems pretty wonderful to me. And the thing that we need to wrap our arms around, or we need to allow to wrap its arms around us, is the fundamental reality that God is a God of grace. Because this is where all of this comes from. God was under no obligation whatsoever to pay back the people of Israel, to pay back me. God had made commitments to the people of Israel, to be sure, but on the basis of a, you will do these things and I will do these things, and the people of Israel never did their things. If you want to look on a quid pro quo kind of thing, or a who owes what kind of standing, God didn't owe the people of Israel anything. And God most certainly didn't owe me anything. When I was making bad choices, one of my bad choices was saying that God doesn't love me if God exists at all. Throwing the fundamental reality of God's love in his face is not the way to make friends with God. God's grace is so much greater than all of that. God didn't have to give the people of Israel anything, or me anything, or you anything. God doesn't need to give us things because God, in the most essential use of the word need doesn't need anything. God is self-contained. God was not lacking something essential before the creation of everything. But God chose to make that creation. And it's God who chose to say, this is the way it works. God chose that there are physical laws that we can't really get around, like physics. God chose that there are some spiritual and moral laws that are just about as hard to get around as physics. But God said, these are my laws. And there are times when I will go against them, which is why we have miracles. And why we have a God who doesn't pay us back what we deserve. Because God is not a God of, what do you deserve from me? God is a God of grace. A God whose essential nature is love. Love to an extent that we can't even fully understand. So when we think of being paid back for things, we're paid back not from the perspective of a banker or a loan shark or a judge or any of those things that we tend to think is what being paid back is all about. We tend to put God into these boxes that say that God behaves just like a banker. You owe God money, He always collects. If He has to foreclose your house, He will. If He has to ruin your health to teach you a lesson, He will. No. It's tempting to think that way, and I understand why we do, and we all fall into it now and then, but I'm here to tell you it's wrong. That isn't the way God works. God often lets our choices take their natural consequences. God's repaid me all kinds of wonderful things in wonderful ways. But you're well aware of the fact that every 3 or 4 years I need a stool here because I need another knee operation because I was an idiot when I was 19 and 20 and 21. He hasn't solved that. On the basis of demographics and actuarial tables, I'm not going to live as long as some people who were born the same year I was because of some of the decisions I made when I was a younger person. That's just a guess, of course, but God isn't necessarily going to override those either. The paying back isn't always this one-for-one kind of thing because it's about us. It's about the grace that we need. It's about taking those things that we lost and replacing them with things that are at least equivalent or often extraordinarily much better. The relationships I had in my late teens and early 20s were awful enough that if I was going to sketch out for you a perfect relationship, it would be one where you didn't hate the other person even half the time. My relationship with Heather is so far beyond that, it's not even measurable. God repaid that eaten up bit in ways that I couldn't even imagine. Because that's who God is. Not a judge. Not someone with a set of scales saying, this is exactly what you owe, and this is exactly what I'll do for you. One of my favorite phrases, I run into it here and there, you run into it in hymns now and then, run into it poems even more in devotional literature here and there. Have you ever run across the phrase, the extravagant grace of God? Every time I see it, it makes me smile, except when it makes me cry. Because it's so astonishing, it's so amazing. If you would have told me when I was 25 what my life would be like when I was 54, I would have laughed in your face. It's so much further than I could even have imagined then. And that's grace. That's nothing I did. I didn't deserve that. It's not even anything my parents did to deserve it on my behalf. It's grace. Oh, to be sure, it's a reflection of those thousands of hours of prayers I'm sure my parents poured into my life and the lives of my brothers and their own. But the repayment wasn't purchased in any meaningful sense of that word. The repayment comes at the hand of a grace-filled and a gracious God. Because if there's one thing we need to take from this, Is it payback? This kind of payback. It's from God's grace. Because of God's grace. And through God's grace. Amen.